too short. Ya think over me rather keep a party in my yard. Life too short. Ya drink some rum, no give a damn when bad mind at all. Life too short. You want was something. Joy and happiness me have in my thoughts. Link up the thugs and the girls. We have no flick up on the grill, let's see church chicken fast. Sunshine, they are everything Irish. Me and no Facebook, no care if you like me. Never bone push from me band, but today me know me a go blazing, me happy like baby pan breast. Me a enjoy myself, check your mother, miss a stress. R.I.P. new meaning, rich I pray me want enjoy me life the fullest. Life too short. Ya think over me rather keep a party in my yard. Life too short. Ya drink some rum, no give a damn when bad mind at all. Life too short. You want more something? Joy and happiness me have in my thoughts. Link up the thugs and the girls. We have no flick up on the grill, let's see church chicken pots. Don't listen nothing where your boss said today. Every day for you, it's like a holiday. Listen soca, some dancehall and reggae. You're hungry?
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah, and I'm your host for today's show. Today on the show, we'll be hearing from Peter Collins and rebroadcasting an interview with Maya Chenoir and news from about Asada Shakur and Bomani Shakur. Our first piece is from Peter Collins. Peter Collins is an artist, cartoonist, writer, and outspoken political activist. He has been incarcerated for over 31 years. Peter has been a regular radio commentator about prison conditions inside Canada's federal prisons, and his interviews have been heard coast to coast for many years. Peter has recently been diagnosed with cancer. His doctors told him that he has months to live. Due to the aggressive nature of the cancer, Peter has had ongoing appointments to the hospital for various treatments. For these hospital trips, the warden at Bath, the prison where Peter is, signed a document with directives to ensure that the guards use limited restraints because of Peter's obvious ill health, as well as his long-time degenerative disc disease, which causes constant pain. Excessive restraints make it impossible for him to get in and out of vehicles that are used, and the CSC doesn't take accessibility into consideration. However, the guards at Bath have refused to follow these procedures. This meant that recently, Peter could not go to the hospital to receive pain management for his cancer. The guard who refused to follow the directives lied to the warden and stated that Peter had refused to have any sort of restraints. This was not the case. Peter will not be able to go to the hospital for pain management until the warden's directive is followed. This leaves Tylenol as the only alternative for pain management as the cancer in his body progresses. In 2010, Peter was supported for full parole, which would have meant his freedom and deportation to England. However, CSC immediately withdrew their support when Peter won a Canadian human rights case against CSC for not accommodating his disability. CSC has never reinstated the support for Peter's parole. It is obvious to many that CSC believes itself above the law and wants to ensure that prisoners do not critique the penal system. It should be noted that Peter has not had any internal charges for over two decades. After Peter received the diagnosis that he only had months to live, he went to see his parole officer to ask for support for a compassionate release. His parole officer stated that he didn't look sick enough, quote unquote. This next piece is by Peter Collins. It's called A Fly in the Ointment.
So this is a story from quite some time ago, but I just wrote it now. So it's called A Fly in the Ointment. In the summer of 1994, I met my lifelong companion, probably one of the least likely relationships anyone could think of. I won't bore you with the many reasons that would just clutter the story. The air was so hot and stagnant, it was difficult to breathe. I lay perfectly still in an effort to avoid any exertion, which might have made it worse. It was one of those sticky, humid days that never seems to end. Half-dressed and face down on my bed, I was drifting in and out of consciousness. I felt her soft finger tracing a line along my back as she whispered loving words to me. I sank deeper into the gentle embrace of sleep's cool darkness. I dreamt of being held, touched, and loved. At some point, I awoke in a disoriented fog. As I struggled to get my bearings, I felt her fingers gently touch my arm, and I closed my eyes again. It felt like a moment, but it could have been an hour or maybe more when a loud noise jarred me awake. Instinct took over and I was on my feet in an instant, ready to defend myself. Reality was slow to join me, but caught up a moment later and I realized where I was. The smashing echoes of steel on steel seamlessly blended it with angry screaming voices. The cacophony of noise was the prison's endlessly cruel heartbeat. A sense of hopeless depression enveloped me. Only a moment ago, I'd been in one of those deliciously pleasureful dreams that felt so real it hurt to wake up. The swarming sense of loss surrounded me and pushed me back onto the unforgiving steel bunk as I realized I wasn't with my wife. It had been years since I'd heard from her, seen her, or been touched by her. I closed my eyes and strained to get back to that wispy dream reprieve. Back to my favorite alternate universe, back to sleep. I lay perfectly still, trying to tune out the metal slamming on metal, the barked orders, the hopeless pleas, and the angry screams. I'd been practicing meditation in prison for over a decade and had some ability to separate myself from my surroundings. Finding peace in the big house is a useful skill to acquire, but forgetting where you are isn't recommended as it can be dangerous in here. I calmed my racing heart while my mind tried to disengage from the cell block. At some point, I drifted into my alternate reality, and again, I felt her gentle touch on my cheek and then my lip. I wanted to retreat into her loving arms. Her touch was feather light, and it tickled me. I shuddered involuntarily, and she was gone. I closed my eyes again, and soon she was back with me. I wanted her to hold me, but she never did. The food slot slammed open and a tray of food was shoved in. I was back in the real world. I got up and looked at the tray with resignation. A warm cup of brownish liquid they called coffee two slices of bread, a scoop of mashed potato, and soggy overcooked green beans with a slice of bologna and a single packet of mustard. I keep telling the food steward I'm a vegan. I don't eat animal products, but he doesn't listen and they just don't care. So sitting next to the toilet, I ate my cold mashed potato sandwich with mushy beans and washed it down with the coffee. I placed my tray on the food slot, and a few moments later, it was pulled out and the slot slammed shut. I heard the guard yelling at someone to return the food tray. I lie down and try to block out the sounds. The dispute is one I've heard 1,000 times before, and it permeates the atmosphere. It echoes in my cell and sinks uncomfortably into my teeth. It feels like chewing tinfoil. I hate hearing these recurrent provocations that flow back and forth so easily from guards and prisoners. Abusive accusations, recriminations, and insult leap out at each other effortlessly and thoughtlessly, with no human regard for the other, each justified in their own positions and never able to see the other's point of view. I try to get back to my wife, but I can't get past the iron door, and the more I try, the further away she becomes. I yearn to drift across the universe to that distant land, but the border crossing is closed. I just can't find sleep. So I sit on the floor with my back to the wall, hoping to absorb some of the coolness from the steel walls and cement floor, but to no avail. So I just sit in the sweltering heat, swimming in my sweat and filth. Showers here at the Hotel California are twice a week, if you get lucky. The guard bangs on the cell door and asks if I want to go to yard. I say no, without thinking. Yard is a small asphalt enclosure with high concrete walls. The sun never shines into the yard, but if you look up past the chain link fence, the razor wire that spans wall to wall like a porous steel roof, you can see the sky, maybe a cloud or two, and occasionally you might even see a bird fly by. No, I wanted to spend some time in the clouds, but with my wife. So I closed my eyes and tried to disengage from reality. The time dragged by and it seemed like I was still in the prison, but somehow I felt her fingers on my leg. Shocked and excited, I opened my eyes, only to realize it was a fly walking on me. I was greedy for human touch, so I closed my eyes and pretended it was her fingers. I tried to stay perfectly still, because I didn't want to frighten the fly off and be left alone. As I sat there, the fly took off and landed on my shoulder. I noticed I was breathing shallowly, as shallowly as I could, in an effort not to disturb the fly. On some level, I realized that this may be considered by the officials, or almost anyone, as strange behavior, but I didn't care what they might think. The world was so far away that nothing mattered. I remember wondering if I should be concerned about diminishing mental capacity. I had read that long-term isolation was bad for mental health. I surmised that simulated human touch was better than none. As I share this story now, I realize that this may be the first recorded symbiotic relationship between a fly and a human. The fly was getting nourishment from the salts and minerals in my sweat in exchange for allowing me to enhance my dreams with simulated human touch and thereby possibly avoid isolation-induced correctional dementia. In any event, I found myself trying to stay very still so I wouldn't frighten the fly away. Whenever I was let out of my cell, I would try to catch more flies and bring them back to my cell, my eyes constantly scanning for flies, no matter what I was doing. If a fly landed on me, I would instantly become still and let them walk around. From time to time, my limited landscape was void of any flies, and whenever there were no flies to accompany me, I felt prison's loneliness more profoundly. I've heard of people becoming more susceptible to depression during the winter months due to a lack of sunshine, but it appears I had a completely different reason. One day, while time was whittling my life away, I felt a sharp pain, and I noticed a fly was on top of a cut on my arm. I waved the fly away, but it came right back to the cut again. After several waves, I realized the fly was very interested in the blood from the cut. I knew that it was probably a bad idea to let a fly walk around drinking from a cut, so I covered the cut with a piece of sticky tape from an envelope. The fly continued to look for the cut, but couldn't find it. As a result, I got the idea to bite my cheek and mix the saliva with the blood and then spread the mixture on the inside of my forearm, as the skin there was more sensitive. The fly was very interested in this and spent a great deal of time walking around on my inner forearm seeking the source. I spread some of the mixture on the sensitive area of my neck. This unconventional relationship has gone on for decades, and while I can't recall how many flies have kept me company throughout my incarceration, I can say I appreciated the moments that they allowed me to dream that I was somewhere else with someone I loved.
That was Peter Collins, a longtime contributor to the Prison Radio Show. We'd also like to share with you a letter written by prisoner rights advocate Giselle Diaz about Peter's situation. Giselle writes, "Dear friends and colleagues, for those of you who have been involved in work of prisoners' rights, HIV/AIDS in prisons, and anti-prison industrial complex organizing, you will most likely know Peter Collins. Peter is a writer, artist, cartoonist, activist, scholar, organizer, and advocate. He's been a dear friend of mine for almost 20 years. When I first met Peter, he was in Collins Bay Penitentiary. He was already active in his criticisms of the system and standing up for people in prison who were being mistreated. When I met Peter, I met my strongest friend and comrade in anti-prison organizing. It is a rare opportunity to meet someone who is adamant that they will stand up for what they believe in, despite all the risks that that would entail for him. He was willing to risk his freedom because he believed that what he was doing was right and just and necessary. Peter has criticized the federal government and the Correctional Services of Canada for ongoing scandals and inane policies, the police for racist policing practices, community organizations for not living up to their mandates, and the list goes on. Peter is a social critic and has often been ahead of others in his criticisms of the structures of violence inherent in the world around us, such as colonialism, racism, imperialism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, sexism, misogyny, etc. In 2008, he won the award for action in HIV/AIDS and human rights. Peter is a staunch advocate for animal rights. He is a vegan and believes in principles of, quote, do no harm to others. Peter would feed the birds at the prison until the staff started killing the pigeons he was feeding. He cares for sick birds and other animals. Peter has painted kids' faces at socials, donated artwork to local animal rescues for fundraising, created music in protest of Marineland and other social issues. He supported violence against women campaigns and had done several art pieces and songs about missing and murdered Indigenous women. Peter participated in the Anti-Violence Project and came up with strategies for anti-bullying campaigns in schools. He has written hundreds of articles, done countless radio interviews, presented at conferences through audio recordings, created short films, and written policy papers. Because of all of these contributions, he has been called anti-authoritarian and held in prison long after his parole eligibility. On Monday, January 12, 2015, we learned that Peter has terminal cancer. It seems that he will not live much longer, possibly months. Despite this news, Peter continues to criticize the system and continues to fight. Peter and I will be creating a zine with some of his writings and artwork. We will be gathering his paperwork to ensure there's an inquest after his death. For those of you who know Peter, who have seen his work, heard him speak, and have been changed because of it, I would ask that you let him know. Prisoners live in a vacuum and often don't get feedback on how their lives have changed us, altered our understandings of prisons, made us stronger advocates, made us better people, and challenged us in how we live, who we love, and how friendships can cross the barriers of prison walls. You can go to his Facebook support page to keep up to date on his health. The Facebook support page is called the Peter Collins Support Committee, and get information about writing a letter to advocate for a compassionate release. In strength, love, and solidarity, Giselle Diaz.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society. Only at that juncture in human society, where it is split between those who have and those who ain't got.
I throw a Molotov cocktail at the precinct. You know how we think. All organize the hood under I Ching banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common needs. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
The average black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty niggas be running with gas. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We're tired of that, corporations hiring blacks. Denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my raps. It's documented, I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathing it. It's more than just fucking believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's C-Lo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
The average black male live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
That was the song Police State by Dead Prez. It's from their 2000 album called Let's Get Free. The time is presently 5:22, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Next up, we have an interview by Ted Asrigadu titled Truth Out Interviews with Maya Chenoir. Maya recently released a book called Locked Out, about the prison system in the United States.
This is Truth Out Interviews. I'm Ted Asrigadu, and on the program is Maya Chenoir. She's the executive director at Truth Out. And Maya's working on a book on prisons in the United States, and she recently penned an article for Truth Out about solitary confinement, the nature of time, and hunger strikes of nearly 30,000 California prisoners who are protesting the arbitrary and excessive solitary confinement treatment in prisons. Maya, hi. Welcome to Truth Out Interviews.
Hi, Ted. It's nice to finally meet you.
You too. Well, first off, why did you want to write a book about prisons and prisoners here in the United States?
For me personally, it started years ago. I had a very close friend from high school who was incarcerated before being deported from the country. And then later, I had an immediate family member, my sister, who was locked up and has continued to be incarcerated over the past few years. So there was really no way for me not to think about the topic. But I think for a lot of people, when you start thinking about it, it's hard to not realize how important it is. You've got 2.3 million people incarcerated in the United States, about 7 million people in the correctional system. So that includes parole and probation. And then you've got all the people who have at some point been incarcerated or on probation. And then this is such a huge population, you've got all their family members and friends and communities who are impacted by the system. So this is a huge issue that impacts a gigantic portion of the country. But it's pretty poorly covered in the media, largely because it mostly affects poor people and people of color, disenfranchised populations who don't have much sway with the media or the government, obviously. And so it becomes a really important thing that needs to be covered by independent media, like Truth Out, if it's going to be covered for real. And also for me, I guess I should say, I have a number of pen pals in prison. These are people who've helped me out with stories in the past or that I've reached out to for other reasons. And sometimes a story pops up that pertains to them in particular. A month ago, it was the death penalty. And then this month, it was the case for these guys at Pelican Bay in solitary confinement.
I mean, just circling back to something that you said earlier about the number of people incarcerated, but also the families that are affected by incarceration. We talk about, and I think a number of the Truth Out writers that have been on this program have mentioned prisons as part of their research and as part of their writing. And how big our prison population in the United States is relative to other countries. And it seems like what you said earlier about the numbers of people that are incarcerated and the people who are affected by those who are incarcerated, it tends to wash over the general public in terms of it's just a statistic because maybe, and I'm just supposing here, because it doesn't happen to them or it's not directly affecting them. So it just becomes a number in a sense. I mean, do you find that when you're researching this or you're talking to people about your project that they didn't realize some of these numbers, these statistics, or even the fact that, you know, it's not just an individual or a group of individuals that are being affected by prison, but there's a larger, if you want to call it a community, but the larger group of people that are as well.
I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. One is that there are certain communities that are very aware of prisons, even if they've never been caught up in the system themselves, just because there are large numbers of people going to prison, being arrested all the time. And these are generally poor communities of color. So that awareness is a constant basic presence for a lot of people in those communities. I know even in Chicago, in North Lawndale, I think 70% of men between 18 and 49 are ex-offenders in the community. And that doesn't even count the people who are incarcerated. So there are places where this is like really known. Conversely, I think because the prison populations are so concentrated, there are a lot of communities where practically no one is incarcerated. And it's kind of a taboo topic to talk about. And for me, I know like when I began having connections with the prison system, it was awkward. You know, people didn't want to talk about it in certain circles that I was involved in. And it does have this extensive impact that maybe isn't acknowledged, partially because there's a sense of shame and stigma around families who are connected with the system. And it's funny because there's this kind of like amorphous sense around acknowledging it, but it has very concrete impacts on those families and then on society as a whole. And one quick thing I'll mention that a lot of people don't acknowledge is there's a financial impact on families, especially since the majority of people going to prison are men who are often the people in families making the most money. And so once that person is incarcerated, regardless of how they're making money, their remaining family members are often destitute, you know, thrown into even worse poverty than they were already in, which is usually a pretty bad state. And that has a ripple effect throughout communities. So that's really important. Also, obviously, breaking up families has huge implications for the way that communities connect with each other, the way that people are able to lead their lives. And also, it falls back on public safety, ironically. When you're constantly uprooting people from their communities, putting them elsewhere, maybe people are leaving those communities because of the stigma of having an incarcerated family member. Maybe the people coming back to the communities after being incarcerated can't actually live in them. There are, for example, restrictions around public housing for people who've been in prison, who have a record. And so these communities get broken up in ways that actually influence crime, that impact crime, because you don't have that kind of neighborhood watch effect, that accountability that comes from knowing your neighbors, convening as a community, that kind of thing. So I think that's important to recognize, that like shooing the bad guys away isn't actually the thing that's going to help us in terms of public safety.
You know, in your piece that you wrote for Truth Out, there's a kind of meditation on the nature of time. For those of us who aren't imprisoned, time, especially nowadays, seems to move very quickly. You know, there are days of marked about how busy we are. Sometimes we're really pulled in different directions, especially with things like social media, where we're constantly asked to update something or compelled to check something. And we just feel like the days go by in a bit of a blur. And we're busy with important things, certainly, but sometimes it's very trivial things, too. But you write about solitary confinement. And solitary confinement and the nature of time. Time is quite different when you have all of these things erased from your life, that you, all the human contact that we tend to take for granted and sometimes find annoying is absent in solitary confinement. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Right. No, you've isolated. There's kind of a paradox there, right? You don't have to do the things that will make you survive. It's like the missions are taken out of life, basically. But therefore, like, the point is also taken out of life. And yeah, I mean, I think also you nailed it down in terms of our days are filled with all these small things and scheduled time-wise, not necessarily trivial things, but small increments. We have this series of missions to accomplish our goals, to take care of ourselves, take care of others, for a lot of people just to survive. And the news cycle keeps up with that fast pace multiplied. Obviously, the news cycle has just been moving quicker and quicker and quicker over the past few years. And in solitary, many of those time markers disintegrate and elongate. The missions are gone, and also other points of demarcation are not there. You're thinking about the number of years between the times you've had true human contact with a family member, the number of years since a phone call. So it's different. When I hear from people in the SHUs, the secure housing unit, solitary, they talk about all the hours over the years of staring at the wall. One guy was telling me, yeah, I like finally learned how to do origami so that the wall wouldn't be so blank. And those hours blend together. And then you've got this news item, the hunger strike, which is vitally important for them and which is being covered in the media. But we're both on the same schedule here. Ah, and so this rapid-paced news cycle, which is now saying something's happening in solitary confinement. Oh, look, it's changed. You know, people are being abused, without acknowledging fully that this was a reality that was ongoing in this slow, excruciating way for decades without coverage. So now it has this news peg, the strike. And the fear is, how long will that last once the prisoners get some concessions, once there's some news in the other direction? And the real story here is this long, slow trudge of the prison system, especially for the people in solitary confinement. But without the flash of that news peg, we just move on to the next item, the next thing on our news schedule. And that happened in 2011 during the last strike. There were two hunger strikes in California about these issues. And once these reforms were implemented, which didn't do anything, they were basically like very weak band-aids, It disappeared from most media, but it still existed just as much for these people, and it was just as bad, but it couldn't keep up with the tide of the news.
Can we talk a little bit about why prisoners are thrown into solitary confinement and why these prisoners were on hunger strikes against this type of treatment?
So there are a number of reasons in different prisons across the country for why people are put in solitary, but it's always like a punishment. It's always a punishment after you've been sentenced. The specific stuff we're talking about in California is mostly confinement in what's called secure housing units, solitary confinement, which is very brutal, because of supposed gang affiliations. And the idea is ostensibly to break up gang members and keep things safe. But most of the people who are placed in these units aren't actually verifiable members of gangs. And even if you think that's a good idea to put people in gangs in these atrocious conditions, it's usually not even true.
How do they know they're even in gang? And what tips off the prison officials that they may be in a gang or something? I mean,
So what they call it when they're not actually in gangs, but they're still confined for gang-related reasons, is they call it association. They're gang associates. And proof of association could be anything. This is up to the discretion of the prison officials. So prisoners' rights literature has been used as an excuse. Possession of African-American history texts, using certain words. I mean, sometimes just exercising with a certain prisoner who has been in a gang can be enough to dub you an associate.
Is the time frame that they're in solitary confinement arbitrary? Because it seems like some are in there for, like, you had one person in there for decades, right? I mean for gang affiliation or for association, that requires that much isolation from everyone else?
It's torture. So that's actually one of their demands for their hunger strike, this idea of indefinite confinement. And actually, the last time that they were on hunger strike last summer, one of the concessions they got, one of the reforms, was a minimum for solitary confinement. So the minimum used to be 6 years, and now it's 4 years. But no maximum was imposed. And so you do have these people who are in for decades and don't have a hope of getting out, and, you know, at least while they're in prison. Of course, for those of them who are getting out of prison, what does that mean for society when you're paroled from the SHU, taken from solitary confinement, put back in society when you're traumatized, debilitated, and have no idea what to do? That's not good for any of us.
Yeah, you have no human contact, and suddenly you're thrust into, if you want to call it civilization, we're thrust back into society, and you're expected just to adapt. But suddenly you're this person who's been isolated, you know, by force, and you have no control over it. And now you're expected to go into society and be, you know, if you want to call it a regular member, a normal member, just like everyone else in a sense, you know, and like that never happened. But you're conditioned after years, if it's like 6 years in solitary confinement, and suddenly they say, well, you know, either you're back in the general prison population, or you're going to get paroled, or you're going to be out. It seems like what they're doing is they're conditioning them to be better prisoners so they can go back into prison.
They're positioning them for prison to be their career, which in some ways, I mean, we talked about, endangers public safety for everyone. If what you're trained to do is be hopeless, be disengaged, be angry, be isolated, sometimes be violent, then those are conditions that you're going to bring back into your communities. And I think another thing is just this sense of, like, punishment as a goal in and of itself, that in terms of prisoners, we were talking about, well, people talk about prisoners in terms of, oh, well, who cares how they're treated? They're getting what they deserve. It's like, all right, well, then what? You know, they, even if you believe that they deserve a certain thing, what purpose does that serve? And it does go back to kind of the founding of these prisons, like when prisons became popular, when they became the primary form of punishment, as we discussed. It was originally this idea that, well, when you isolate people, you're putting them in a position to reflect, to think about God, to get in touch with your spirituality and realize that there must be a better way, and that your obedience to God would overtake your impulses toward crime or to evil. And obviously, solitary confinement didn't work that way. And that goal kind of fell off, and the punitive goal remained, and it doesn't have any kind of end purpose for anyone. It's just basically, at this point, torture.
People in general, it's difficult for them to have sympathy for prisoners, because if you go to prison, chances are you committed some crime so bad that it necessitated you to be taken out of society and put into an isolated place, whether it's a general prison population or whether it's solitary confinement. So people are jailed because they've committed a crime. So suddenly they have that mark that they are a criminal. And it's very difficult for people to feel like, why should I have sympathy for the plight of prisoners? Why should I be concerned about their treatment when they themselves individually acted in a horrendous way, quite possibly, and there's that sense that they're getting what they deserved, if not more. And so when you write about prisons, and people that have come before you and certainly will come after you and write about prisons and are talking about these conditions, what does this really say about our society, and why should we care as a society about what goes on in prisons, especially like with solitary confinement and other types of treatment?
I mean, I think one thing kind of overarching, and then I'll talk more specifically, to think about is what you and I have really been discussing is like a systemic thing. It's prisons fundamentally not working the way they are right now. And so even if you have no sympathy whatsoever for prisoners, even if you remove sympathy from the equation, when it comes down to it, lots of people who are reassured by the idea of prison are fundamentally wrong. You know, the bad guys aren't staying away, and it's not preventing violence, and it's certainly not preventing the kinds of things that perpetuate negative phenomena in our society. Like, prison is not a solution. I think coming back to the idea of guilt and the idea of getting what you deserve, it's funny because there are all different reasons why people land in prison. And for some people, simply being black or brown or poor is enough of a crime to get you in prison for something that someone who's middle class and white would never get in prison for, would never get in trouble for. And so things like small drug crimes, minor theft, most of the time people are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. And the way that prison affects their lives, both during and after their incarceration, this punitive system really massively impacts their existence and puts them in this position of struggling even more. And so it could be very sympathetic in these common scenarios if you think of those backstories and why people end up there. And oftentimes people are going to prison because of their background and how they look and their identity, as opposed to being a danger to society. But in terms of people who are classified as dangerous, and I think that, you know, a lot of the prisoners in Pelican Bay, the reason they're there is because they've been determined to be dangerous because they've committed a violent crime. And I think, like, you can think about it in terms of the functioning of the system, and you can also think about it as a human rights issue. So in terms of the functioning of the system, if people are committing violent crimes, they're hurt people, right? So you're putting them in this position where they're more distanced, more angry, more hopeless, and then that punishment goes on to affect what they do next and the impact they have on people on the outside, even while inside of prison. Secondarily, in terms of solitary confinement, beyond the system not working, these are very stark human rights violations. When I characterize it, people say, you know, cruel and unusual punishment, dehumanization, medieval torture, the way that people who get this label are all of a sudden not human and you can do whatever you want to them. These people are being treated worse than animals. And we have to look at ourselves and say, what kind of society do we want to live in if we allow human beings, because they're still human, to be treated in this way? And also, what are we getting out of it? How do we think that this punishment is going to further our society, is going to make us safer? And how abusing and traumatizing people could ever be a positive thing for the country and the world? What does it do for us?
I think we're going to leave it there. Maya, I want to thank you for being on the program and talking to us about this project that you're working on. And we get a taste of it on Truth Out in terms of the article that you penned. And you do have a number of interviews with prisoners that you've done, and that is also posted on Truth Out. That's correct, right?
Those interviews are done by the Center for Constitutional Rights. So the prisoners that I quote on my column this month and last month, that's a separate thing. That's my correspondence. But yeah, this latest Pelican Bay series, we're actually taking the words of prisoners, and those are directly posted to the site.
And this is all leading to a book, which is probably going to come out in a year or so?
Yeah, the book is actually not about solitary confinement in particular. The book is about the relationships between prisoners and folks on the outside and the relationship between prison and society on the outside. So it's a slightly different focus, but these issues definitely figure in.
Do you have a title yet?
I'm going back and forth so much that I don't even want to say anything.
All right. Well, when it comes out, of course, we'll have you back on and we'll have the official title and we can talk more in depth about that.
Sounds good.
Maya Shanwar, she is the executive director of Truth Out, and as we've been talking about prisons, and she's currently in the process of writing a book about this in a larger context. Make sure you read Maya's work, share it with your social networks, and subscribe to this channel, because we do these interviews roughly once a week, sometimes every other week. I just want to thank you again, Maya, for being on the program, and thank you for watching Truth Out Interviews. I'm Ted Asfergadu. We'll see you next time.
That was an interview between Ted Asfergadu and Maya Shanwar. We found that interview on YouTube. Maya is the editor-in-chief of truthout.org. Up next, we have an update on Bomani Shakur's appeal. The Prison Radio Show has been following Bomani's case for years. Bomani Shakur, also known as Keith Lamar, is a prisoner in Ohio, condemned to death on false charges following the 1993 Lucasville prison uprisings. Bomani is one of the five men condemned to death after being railroaded through forced snitch testimony. The group of men is called the Lucasville Five.
Earlier this month, the United States Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in the appeal of Ohio death row prisoner Bomani Shakur, whose government name is Keith Lamar. Bomani is one of the five prisoners prosecuted as the Lucasville Five, targeted as ringleaders of the weeks-long prisoner uprising that occurred at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio, in 1993. If you do the math, you realize this is a 21-year-old legal battle so far. Bomani was identified, targeted, prosecuted, and condemned to death strictly on the testimony of other prisoners. There existed no security footage, no DNA, no fingerprint evidence, only the accounts of other convicted felons who may or may not have had their own motives to lie, who may or may not have attributed their own criminal behavior to Bomani. And while hundreds of prisoners were involved in the uprising, investigators only collected statements, it seems, from less than 100 of them. So we must conclude that either hundreds of prisoners had no idea what occurred, suffering mass amnesia, or investigators simply chose not to take note of their accounts. Bomani himself has written extensively. His account was published last year, entitled Condemned. It's an excellent read, and is very revealing with regard to the tactics the state used in its frame-up of targeted prisoners in the aftermath of the riot. I sent my copy to Governor Jaywal, who never even had the courtesy to write me back and tell me what he thought of the book. What an ingrate. So anyway, the hearing. The reason this court hearing was so crucial is that the U.S. Court of Appeals would either decide to vacate Bomani's conviction or to set an execution date. Since the U.S. Supreme Court hears only 3% of cases, that means this was Bomani's last good shot at being heard. Bomani wasn't permitted to attend, of course, but more than 100 supporters packed the courtroom. His attorney, David Dalton, was also there, but Bomani and his attorney haven't been on speaking terms for quite some time. Imagine that, facing execution and being excluded from a hearing where your only hope is in someone who isn't speaking with you, to convince three judges who never met you that you shouldn't be strapped to a table and murdered. The panel hearing arguments was composed of two white conservatives appointed by Bush and one black centrist appointed by Clinton. Not exactly a dream for a black prisoner condemned in the death of a white guard, a conviction rubber-stamped by lower courts for 21 years. But, according to observer accounts, the arguments went incredibly well. Links to a report back and even the audio of the hearing can be accessed online. The principal argument presented by Bomani's attorney is the unfairness of the state withholding important evidence. In a process never previously employed in any other case, prosecutors at Bomani's trial gave his attorneys a list of prisoner names and a stack of anonymous statements. It was left to counsel to attempt to mix and match statements to the prisoners who made them, and then attempt to figure out which statements were credible and which ones impeached which. The judges even referred to this as a mix-and-match game and asked the prosecutor why such a process was undertaken. The prosecutor could provide no coherent answer, and one judge followed up to clarify that not even the prosecutor could justify such a process, one that could only be, by design, an effort to confuse and obstruct Bomani's defense. Instead, the prosecutor intended to argue some kind of procedural minutia that Bomani's attorney shouldn't have filed something within a legal time frame because that time frame was going to change in the future. In other words, the court should ignore a deliberate injustice and murder an innocent man because his counsel didn't exercise psychic powers to anticipate a future change in court rule. So the real question before the Court of Appeals is whether the courts will turn a blind eye to prosecutors and prison officials scapegoating those they don't like, killing with a needle the fortunate few that the Darren Wilsons don't happen to shoot.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
The real question is whether the United States will yet again become the murderer that Bomani is falsely accused of being. Free the Lucasville Five. Check out the links where this segment gets posted. This is Ohio Governor in Exile elect Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville - Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. For more information about Bomani Shakur's appeal, check out lucasillamnesty.org.
That was a piece from Sean Swain's show, which is called You Are the Resistance. Sean was talking about the case of Keith Lamar, also known as Bomani Shakur, who's currently on his final appeal of his death sentence. Shakur stands convicted of masterminding the death of 9 snitch prisoners during the Lucasville uprisings of 1993, which he denies.
The moratorium on deportations to Haiti and Zimbabwe has been lifted. 3,500 are threatened with possible removal. There will be a community assembly on Saturday, January 31st, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Bureau de la Communauté Haïtienne de Montréal, 6970 Rue Marquette, near Metro Fabre. Organized by Solidarity Cross Borders. For more info, www.solidaritycrossborders.org or phone 438-933-7654. Let's organize together to resist the deportations of members of our community. No deportations, status for all. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The time is presently 5:54, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. To close out our show today, we have a couple of news items. The next event in the Month Against Prisons is a day-long event at UChem on women in prisons. The day starts at 11 a.m. with a workshop on lawyers and prison with the Feminism and Law Collective at UChem. The workshop will take place at Café Aquin, which is located in building A, and it's room number 2445 at UChem, which is the Université de Québec à Montréal. The day continues at 1 p.m. with a workshop in French on women and the carceral system. That workshop will also take place at Café Aquin, which again is located at Pavilion A, room number 2445 at UChem. There will be another workshop at 3:30, which will be in English, and it will be about the connections between prison and gender violence, and it will be with Kelly Fogg Black. That workshop will take place in room A2860, which is Pavilion A at UChem. An art show in Brooklyn is featuring the art of political prisoners and Prison Radio correspondent Rashid Johnson. As prisonradio.org reports, Respond, an exhibit at the SMAT Gallery in Brooklyn, New York, is currently exhibiting an artistic response to the recent events of racist extrajudicial police violence. PrisonRadio.org correspondent Rashid is not only an eloquent writer and learned political theoretician, but also a talented artist. He currently resides in a solitary hellhole in Texas Department of Corrections in Clements Unit in Amarillo, Texas. The exhibit is getting rave reviews and write-ups in numerous publications. The New York Times refers to Johnson's work as, quote, a fine multi-part narrative drawing, and notes that, quote, Mr. Johnson's work, which goes back in time, opens the show to histories. PrisonRadio.org recognizes the role of art in social justice movements, which has been a constant and essential one. The exhibit, Smack Mellon, or the exhibit is located at Smack Mellon, 92 Plymouth Street, Washington Street, Brooklyn, New York, and the show runs until February 22nd. To find out what's coming up next on the Prison Radio Show and or other prison and prisoner-related activities in the region, check out our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and click on the calendar section. If you would like us to post an event you are hosting, email us at prison@ckut.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, February 12th at 5 p.m., If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at the Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? Brought to you live.